It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The federal public health emergency for COVID ends. How do we take stock of this moment here in Wisconsin? Add your voice to the conversation. Call in with questions at any point. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Mary Beth Graham is an internal medicine and infectious disease specialist at the Medical College of Wisconsin and the medical director of infection prevention and control at Froedtert Hospital. Dr. Graham, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, let's size up this moment. What is the significance of the end of the public health emergency?
I think emotionally for a lot of people, it marks an end of potentially a lot of angst on both sides, but it marks the next stage of what we need to do for preparedness. It's not the end of thinking about pandemics and thinking about COVID, but really, where do we go next? And that I think is, you know, most people are saying with what WHO did last week, saying, okay, the pandemic is over. The global health emergency is over. Now our public health emergency is over. As an infectious disease specialist, I still see patients with COVID. I'm still running clinical trials at Froedtert and Medical College, trying to investigate new medications which can be used to treat SARS-CoV-2. And the issue is that we still have a long way to go in terms of understanding what we've been through in the last 2 years, understanding better treatments for this, looking at things like long COVID. There are so many questions that have come out of this in terms of what's long COVID, what can we do to help people? But I also look at it as what did we learn from this with regards to how do we respond to that next pandemic, inevitably will come.
I'm so interested in getting into your lessons learned. But first, you know, do you think this was an appropriate time for the federal government to end the health emergency?
You know, if you look at what the public health emergency covered and with the end of it, what is no longer covered versus what is still covered. If you look at things like testing, you know, so the medications to treat are still available, but understanding now it's up to private insurance or Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera, to pay for things like Paxlovid, Molnupiravir, or Remdesivir, rather than being covered under the public health emergency. Vaccinations do not change because those should be covered by most, should be free to the public in most scenarios, or if with certain types of insurance, they will still be covered. I think that as we look at, you know, from our standpoint, there's a lot that changes in the hospital because over the last week, it's just been nonstop conversations about what do we do with mitigation efforts. So by mitigation, mostly what we've been doing is masking. And we stopped testing people coming in. But does that mean all of that stops? And that's really a balancing act that our institution is looking at with regards to where is it reasonable to continue in a hospital setting certain mitigation efforts, and with which populations should we really focus? Again, SARS-CoV-2 has changed a lot. The beginning of the pandemic, it was a lot of hospitalizations, a lot of deaths, and it was a much different, those earlier variants were very different than what we have right now with Omicron. And will Omicron continue, you know, will it change back? Hopefully not to something like Delta or one of the earlier guys that was causing a lot of death and hospitalizations. But I think that the end of the public health emergency, you know, from my standpoint as an infectious disease physician, is it doesn't change our preparedness. It doesn't change what we're thinking about to try to improve the health of the patients that we see, to try to seek out new treatments. And I think for the public, I hate to say it this way, I think a lot of people were just over COVID a long time ago. So the end of the public health emergency probably is like, yeah, who cares? We were over it a long time ago. But you look at it differently in healthcare because we have to think about what do we need to do next to be prepared?
Talking about the end of the public health emergency for the pandemic, Dr. Mary Beth Graham here, the medical director of infection prevention and control at Frederick Hospital. You can join in, add your questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. Graham, you just brought up the testing in clinic, in ERs, and it calls to mind that we had access from the federal government, these free at-home tests. And I'm just wondering, you know, what changes will it make with the public health emergency going away where we won't have access to these tests anymore? And I'm just wondering, does that mean that people won't be able to know for sure unless they go to a doctor or go to the ER?
So there actually still are access. You can still have access to free tests. Even the state of Wisconsin has this great website, Say Yes COVID Test, where you put that in Google finds everything. You can find this because the Department of, basically the state health department has expanded the testing. You can go on there. I mean, go on. You can order your free test for home through Medicare and Medicaid. People can still order their free test for home. If you go to your local pharmacy and want to get a test, that will essentially probably not be covered by your health insurance. You'll need to pay out of pocket. I mean, all the way along, people have paid. You know, some people have paid for those tests by going to their local pharmacy. But if you go to the doctor to get the swab, that will be charged the same as getting like a complete blood count. So if you're going for a blood test and you get your laboratory charge for that, if you're going into a healthcare facility or someplace else to get your, you know, to get a lab test done, that will incur a charge, whereas previously it did not. But the home antigen test, there are still avenues to get those free.
You know, looking back in that rearview mirror, what do you think, you know, we learned as a country in how we responded to the pandemic?
I think that there are a number of issues. Number one, politics really needs to stay out of this. I think that's probably the most important thing, because if we look back at the beginning of the SARS-CoV-2, of the COVID pandemic, there were some really interesting and novel things that happened. If we look over the past, just in the 21st century, we've had a number of global outbreaks and pandemics, and we've learned from each of them. So even before COVID showed up, when we had Zika and when we had SARS-1 and we had MERS, et cetera, the federal government came in and developed this thing called the emergency use authorization so that the FDA can get therapies to people sooner. That happened in 2017. And that was actually really fantastic because it was a base by which we could get therapies to people quicker during this pandemic. So, you know, we learn from each one of these experiences. Then when we come into SARS-CoV-2, I look back on what the intent of Operation Warp Speed is. And I don't care what your, you know, purple, blue, green, I don't care what your political affiliation is, but the concept behind Operation Warp Speed was essentially meant to be a public-private collaboration to allow companies, et cetera, to do what they do best to get products to the market as quickly as possible with oversight with the federal government, rather than the federal government getting in there and kind of like stirring the pot. So the theory behind it at the beginning was fantastic. What ended up happening over time was it essentially became more and more political. My hope is as we go forward with the next pandemic, we don't have that same stirring of the pot. And I hope we learned from this for the next time.
Infectious disease specialist Mary Beth Graham helping us to reflect on the end of the federal COVID public health emergency and what battling the disease might look like going forward in Wisconsin. Call in with questions at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with internal medicine and infectious disease specialist Dr. Mary Beth Graham from the Medical College of Wisconsin, exploring this new phase of the pandemic as the public health emergency ends and lessons learned over 3 years. Be part of this discussion about healthcare and COVID. Call in with a question at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Graham, with the public health emergency over, but COVID, as you mentioned, still circulating, still killing people, what precautions should we take moving forward to keep ourselves safe?
So the good thing about COVID right now is that the majority of cases that we're seeing, even though there's still large amounts of community transmission, there are much fewer hospitalizations. We still have people dying, but it tends to be those at highest risk for complications. So either our immunocompromised patients, our patients who have underlying, you know, lung disease, et cetera. Whereas early on in the pandemic, we were seeing young individuals who essentially could succumb. So it's changed. The virus has changed. That's not to say the virus couldn't change to do something else, but the hope is that's not what's going to happen. And as we, you know, as we look at it with, again, the end of this, of the public health emergency, I look at it as we, when we're looking at this, we still recognize what we need to do to treat this. And as I mentioned, continued clinical trials. And there have been some really beautiful papers that have been written after, during this time, that talk about what's needed globally for pandemic preparedness. Because even if you look in our most recent history, Zika, which we talked about, was referred to as a global outbreak pandemic, even though people didn't put the pandemic. Monkeypox or mpox was essentially a global outbreak that really fit the definition of what could be called a pandemic. We've had COVID. So we've had a number of different infectious pathogens just in the last, you know, 10 plus years that we've had to deal with. And what's come out of that, though, is really a really very sophisticated approach with basic scientists to be able to monitor what we call zoonoses. So they are being able to monitor pathogens and then look at them to see how they circulate and can they jump into humans. The most recent one that we've talked about on the news is H5N1 that we're seeing in a large number of bird colonies, but it hasn't quite figured out how to jump into humans. And that's always a concern, because could we get a pandemic with a new strain of influenza? So again, monitoring those pathogens is really, really important. So that's has increased. The other thing that's improved is sequencing, because the technology has become much better. And if you know the sequence, the genetic sequence of that pathogen, then you can figure out better ways to go after it, especially with vaccine development. The other thing for pandemic preparedness is, I would say that I am hoping happens in the future, and this is, again, what started with Operation Warp Speed, and I hope continues, is that we need to strengthen manufacturing so that we've got private sector who will be incentivized to work on certain types of therapies or interventions, and that governments essentially, where they need to provide support to develop those, can do that so that we have it available production distribution in a short period of time. And I would say probably the most incredible thing that happened, and I know there's a lot of controversy over mRNA vaccines, but mRNA technology and adenoviral vector vaccines, that was the J&J vaccine, really just the technology and the understanding and the support to develop that type of approach to vaccine development has been
remarkable, phenomenal
in the last several years.
But on the flip side, getting people to take it, and there was so much concern and misinformation, you know, with vaccine uptake. What is your lesson learned there in terms of the misinformation that you were battling as a physician?
Well, that's a really, really tough one, because, I mean, with the mRNA technology, The reality is a number of new vaccines that are going to be offered in the future are going to be that technology. And it's trying to explain to people that mRNA does not change your genetic material. You have little enzymes in your body that chew up that mRNA. It goes in, it kind of makes a signal, but then your body chews it up. So it's not sticking around. And again, looking at going back and looking at some of the studies that were done saying, okay, this was associated with this type of a complication in this group, trying to learn more from that. I mean, again, there's so much that we still have to learn from what we've been through, looking at the vaccines, again, looking at long COVID, but we're a lot further along now than we were at the beginning. And I think that people are not going to give up that, you know, that thirst for knowledge to keep going forward. Because again, being in the medical field, our ultimate goal is we want our patients happy. We want ourselves that, you know, healthy and happy. We want to prevent the spread of disease. We want to do everything we can and use all of the things that we can do. And until we have all those other tools, I'm back to the, you know, stop the spread. So thinking about stopping the spread, I'm just going to bring up, I don't know if you read about this, but just recently the CDC had a conference last week where their EIS officers all got together and they had a COVID outbreak. So again, when you're getting large groups of people together, you know, again, think about the, you know, the environment where you're at, and are those situations where potentially you might want to wear a mask or social distance or do something, or be very aware of what your symptoms are and not go where you might spread something to somebody else. So I'm hoping it's raised that type of awareness.
Dr. Mary Beth Graham with us, infectious disease specialist, internal medicine. You can join in the conversation about COVID, what you would like to bring up. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Graham, let's go a little bit more deeply into long COVID. What have doctors been learning in terms of treating long COVID and how it's evolving?
So the problem with long COVID is that it's not just one type of syndromic, it's just not one syndromic disease. There are people who will have fatigue. There are other people who have more neurologic symptoms with dizziness. There are some people who will have chronic pulmonary. There's all different types of presentations of what is classified as long COVID. In July of 2021, long COVID was actually added to as a condition that's recognized as a disability under the ADA. But again, the question is, how do you actually make that diagnosis? And then how do you approach it for treatment? There is no standard treatment. It's usually symptomatic treatment based on what somebody is complaining of at the time. There are some really, really interesting websites, especially with basically physical medicine and rehabilitation society has published the post, it's called PASC now rather than long COVID, which is the post acute sequela of SARS-CoV-2, which, yeah, whatever, long
mouthful.
COVID.
Uh-huh.
but they have, you know, some guidance with regards to potential treatments that providers can do. And then people can look at these sites and figure out, okay, should I see this type of provider or which type of provider to try to approach some of their symptoms? But there is so much we don't know. Mm. I mean, I'm just going to be honest. There's a lot that we don't know. It reminds me back to chronic fatigue syndrome from a number of years ago, just really recognizing the reality, but how do you actually, you know, I mean, there's still controversy on what you do with chronic fatigue.
We only have a few seconds left, but this is personal. With so much burnout in the medical profession, how are you doing at this point?
You know, it's one of those things, I continue to feel energized. I'm very excited about being involved in these clinical trials to look for new treatments because I feel it's important. The other thing is I feel very, very passionate about protecting our most vulnerable populations who would have the worst sequela from SARS-CoV-2. So here at Frederick in the Medical College of Wisconsin, we're discussing our masking initiatives. And as a, what I do primarily on the inpatient services, I do transplant ID, and I see our malignant heme patients, our solid organ transplant patients, and I've seen what it can do to those populations. And so really making strong pitches for additional mitigation efforts that we should do, teaching our patients what they can do to protect themselves.
Oh, Dr. Graham, thank you for joining us. Mary Beth Graham, internal medicine and infectious disease specialist at the Medical College of Wisconsin. For disclosure, Freidert and Medical College of Wisconsin are business sponsors of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Wisconsin and the nation wind down the emergency COVID response, we hear from physicians in our state about what COVID treatment and care will be like in the future. Call in with a question, any point. The number to join in the conversation, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Mark Thompson is Chief Clinical Officer at SSM Health Wisconsin Region. Dr. Thompson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. And Dr. Allison Schwartz is here, infectious disease physician with SSM Health in Wisconsin, also an associate medical director for the infectious disease department. Dr. Schwartz, welcome back.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, Dr. Schwartz, let's start with you. You were treating patients throughout the pandemic. What was it like for you to be on the front lines these past few years?
I think there's a lot to reflect on over the past 3 years. I mean, certainly going back to the early days, I was just reminiscing. I was one of the ID docs on call when we had one of our first patients in an SSM hospital in Wisconsin. And, you know, at that point, there was really a paucity of literature. We didn't really know how to treat these patients. And I remember being up at like 2 a.m. and reading articles translated from Korean, trying to figure out what to do. So certainly a lot has changed. And I think it's really amazing to think back on how much we've learned, how quickly we all kind of came together and collaborated. Between specialties, between institutions, you know, in various areas of research, and really at the end of the day, doing what we could to protect our communities and care for our patients. It's been a really amazing transformation. I think, you know, we're all happy to be kind of winding down and on the other side of things, but a lot of positives to reflect on as well.
A lot of mysteries solved along the way in the 3 years, but what is yet to solve? What still keeps you up at night?
I think that's a great question. I mean, we've learned so much. There's still so much that we need to learn. I mean, there's ongoing research as far as our therapeutics for patients, still working that for patients as soon as they're diagnosed with COVID, you know, what is the best course of action. Of course, we have, you know, Paxlovid and molnupiravir and all of these drugs that we use, but what does the future look like? Also talking about vaccines and then on top of just acute COVID, there's still a lot of ongoing research for those patients who've had COVID and continue to suffer from long COVID symptoms. And that's a big area where we're continuing to learn, and there's a lot of unknowns. You know, in addition to what keeps me up at night, it's just kind of this general preparedness of, okay, we got through COVID. In the future, when there's another pandemic, how are we gonna handle that? And I think we're a lot better equipped from that standpoint. We've learned so much, but it's definitely that I think, you know, we want to put COVID behind us, but with, you know, kind of that awareness that something else probably will be in the future, and what will we do to manage it?
Yes. Dr. Thompson, let's take stock. What have been the biggest challenges for SSM Health in navigating the pandemic from your vantage point?
Yes. Thank you so much for that question. And, you know, being kind of background in military training, here, I really have thought a lot about readiness. You know, we have normal day-to-day operations and response to healthcare needs, but readiness for an emergency, readiness for the next pandemic, really thinking about how do we mobilize people, equipment, supplies, supply chain was just a really eye-opening experience for us. And thinking about, you know, staffing and needs so that we are ready for the unknown.
you know, hospital equipment. I mean, remember the shortage of ventilators and the shortage of PPE. What have been the takeaways there?
Absolutely. So one of the things that, again, eye-opening to me, as we worked on reducing healthcare costs, I mean, people want lower healthcare expenses, employers want lower healthcare expenses, and we started following some of the same business practices that other organizations, other industries have followed. And we went down to like single supplier to get the lowest cost supplies. In a pandemic, that's a problem when there's supply chain interruption. So we've evolved our thinking as far as stockpiling, but also working with multiple suppliers. So we have more flexibility to flex up in situations like a pandemic. So that certainly has been an eye-opening experience for us.
What about burnout? You know, you oversee over 1,000 healthcare providers in Wisconsin. What toll has this taken on your workforce?
When you look at that, just the level of care, the level of commitment, and when the rest of the world was, you know, shutting down, quieting down, essentially sheltering in place, there are some industries that had to ramp up, you know, and healthcare was one of them. We couldn't send our frontline caregivers home. They took extraordinary steps, and they haven't had that rest, that catch-up period, and it certainly has taken a toll. We've had people leave the workforce early, retire early, and certainly those that have stayed have had increased workloads related to meeting, you know, patients' needs and communities' needs. So that certainly has impacted our physicians, our nurses, our frontline caregivers, even our support staff. So we're doing programming like Care for the Caregivers and working on resiliency training across the organization. We're doing what something called a Schwartz round, where people can come together and really talk about these things. So that is it will be an ongoing work moving forward, and we're still recovering.
Dr. Schwartz, what comes up for you when we talk about burnout?
Honestly, the first thing that came to mind for me is that even, you know, to this day, when I have patients express gratitude, it really is meaningful. I think it's more meaningful now than it's ever been in the past. And that sort of reminds you why we do the things we do. And I have patients who might be grateful for the care they're receiving now, or sometimes they'll make retrospective comments of, gosh, yeah, you guys are ID docs. You've been here through the pandemic. I can't believe you did that. And that really means a lot for me. So I think a lot of other caregivers would sort of emphasize that point. In the beginning, everyone was hailing healthcare workers as heroes and, you know, pulling out of the stops. And 3 years later, it's like, we're still here. We're still doing this. Even a little bit of appreciation from the community goes a long way. And if it's just a small thank you for the care you've received, it's really, really helps when we talk about burnout and just the trauma from the past few years.
That's point taken there. Talking about the end of the federal public health emergency for the pandemic, Dr. Allison Schwartz and Dr. Mark Thompson from SSM Health, you can join in along the way, your questions, your experiences, how you're reflecting on today. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Schwartz, the federal public health emergency ending today. I'm wondering, do you think this is an appropriate time for it to end?
I do. I think, you know, hospitalizations and deaths that we're seeing from COVID are, you know, way down. Some figures say down like 90%. We have good vaccines. We have great therapeutics. I think now is a good time sort of to move on. I think it's important for everyone to remember that doesn't mean COVID is not here. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't continue to take, you know, appropriate cautions in high-risk settings, or if you're immune compromised, really talking to your providers, making sure you're up to date on your vaccinations, you know, wearing masks in certain settings if it's appropriate for you and what your immune status may be. But as a general sense for the United States and really now the rest of the world, that it does seem appropriate to end at this time.
Dr. Thompson, how will this moment, the end of the public emergency, affect the resources available to healthcare workers?
Yes, we still again, I think we've learned just an incredible amount and certainly have changed the way we've gone about things based on our learnings. And so we have good resources, good levels of equipment, ability to flex up. We have had a lot of practice on what we call incident command and responding to a crisis like COVID. We did that incident command response for almost 3 years. And so we have a lot of practice and ability to meet needs. I would just encourage our communities, our patients, our healthcare systems, and our both, you know, public and our private healthcare systems to continue to work together to support each other and our caregivers and our work with our patients.
What about the financials, though? I mean, we are seeing hospital mergers. Are clinics, our hospitals, are they emerging financially stable on the other side?
I will say what we've seen in general in healthcare, last year was a very difficult year financially for many healthcare systems. And we've seen a lot happen with the workforce, and that is something that we're continuing to work with as far as what we are reimbursed from insurance companies, as well as federal and state payers. There's still ongoing work with that. I am confident we'll get things sorted out. We're here for our patients. We're here for our communities, and been here for 100 years, and we'll continue to be here to do that work.
Chief Clinical Officer at SSM Health Wisconsin Region, Dr. Mark Thompson there, providing insight as the federal emergency declaration for the COVID pandemic sunsets today. We have infectious disease physician Allison Schwartz. Call in with a question. What is on your mind? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. All but two Wisconsin counties are at low COVID community transmission levels, that latest posted Friday by the Department of Health Services. We reflect on what it means to move away from the emergency response. Call in with your question, 800-642-1234. We have SSM Health Infectious Disease Specialist Allison Schwartz here and Chief Clinical Officer at SSM Health Wisconsin Region, Dr. Mark Thompson. Let's bring in Sue now in the town of Dunn. Sue, hi. What is your story?
Well, I'm a school nurse, and I cannot thank the infectious disease folks and the doctors and all my colleagues, especially this week during Nurses Week. As a school nurse, of course, there were some wonderful celebrations, but there were a couple tough patches. But the support we received on the front line, I got to thank Dr. Thompson and Dr. Schwartz for all their support.
Sue, what did you learn as a school nurse going through this pandemic? What was eye-opening to you?
We had to fly by the seat of our pants. When you'd have one mandate would come out and it would change, and then we were looked at as the experts, but we were no more experts than the newest mandate. You know, it was tough. You really learned you learned a lot about human nature. I'll put it that way. That's a good way to put it.
Sue, thank you so much for sharing. Dr. Thompson, go ahead. What comes up?
Again, one of the things that I think that working with community, we've learned so much, and so appreciative of all of the connections that we've had and just dealing with the complexities of human nature and fear and unknown and how we can help move people along to create the safest places for themselves and their families and their community. And I think of employers, I think of giving immunizations in a park setting. I think about the first kids that stepped forward and had immunizations. And some of these things were controversial to people and how we had to really come together and talk about safety of the individual safety of the community and navigate all of these unknowns together. So it's just a challenging experience, but such an important experience. And just thankful for everybody really working together and supporting each other. I just want to call it all of our health systems, you know, that came together across the country and specifically in Wisconsin, just wonderful, wonderful partnership and doing common good together.
Dr. Schwartz, how did you see that collaboration in the hospital setting?
Well, we came together really quickly through all of SSM with an infectious disease group that also included, you know, other specialists, pulmonologists, and some of the hospitalists and critical care doctors from all across of SSM coming together. Really, we were meeting like several times a week to help develop protocols. So this includes our hospitals in Illinois and Oklahoma, really all over the state and Missouri, obviously. Everyone collaborating, sharing research, and then also, you know, more locally within Madison, reaching out to other, you know, our infection preventionists at UW and making sure that we were all on the same page and doing what was best for the patients. And I think, you know, for us as a system, it's really helped develop some of the work we continue to do it within my field of infectious disease. And, you know, if you recall, obviously, right after COVID, we had that time we were dealing with monkeypox, and that all sort of we were set up for success from that standpoint because we had all collaborated and were coming together and developing protocols. It was really great.
You know, as Sue said, flying by the seat of your pants and information changing so rapidly, at the same time, you had to really debunk treatment myths around like ivermectin and around chlorine, which, you know, chemicals that could really cause serious harm if misused to your patients. What was COVID misinformation like for you as a physician, and how do you address it now?
You know, I think that was a challenge for everyone, right? And it still comes up today. You'll see things on the internet and it just sort of makes me shake my head. But we really have to lean into the science. And I think that's sort of my takeaway from all of this. In the beginning, everyone wanted to do anything that might possibly help, kind of that kitchen sink approach. But we've learned over time and through a lot of these research studies that have been global research studies with sites all over the world, that some of these treatments may have done more harm than good. And so it's really important that even if you read something or hear something, unless there's good evidence-based research to back that up, that you really need to tread cautiously. And that's what I just continue to, you know, lean into the science and try and debunk any myths. And I think it's important to meet people where they are because it has become quite controversial. And so you don't want to, you know, really discredit someone if they feel passionately about something. But if we can just go on fact-based, you know, evidence-based medicine, that's really going to be what will guide me and my recommendations for treatment.
Dr. Thompson, certainly at points in the pandemic, and even now, there's all this friction around employee vaccines and being vaccinated for COVID. What do you see now, and especially as it relates to misinformation?
Absolutely. You know, I think we look at our core of existence and in healthcare, you know, many of us have been called to this position to really care for the sick and the vulnerable, right? And we really lead with that duty and that obligation to make sure that we're prepared and prepped to care for the sick and the vulnerable. And that's why so many have stood up and bled out and, you know, willingly took the immunization. I was very glad to be able to get mine. And then, you know, certainly have worked on putting systems around that readiness as far as the mandates around vaccines. So we are prepared and we are safe and we are able to care for the sick, the vulnerable, and your loved ones when they need it. And we'll continue to lead out with that at SSM Health. And I know my colleagues at all health systems will continue to do that. And we go back to science and studies, and you know, I trust our scientific community, and I know things came rapidly with this. It was truly a miracle, and I am thankful for it. And we'll continue to put our trust in science and study together.
I want to touch down, Dr. Thompson, on your communication methods, because I'm just curious, with your military background, how has communication changed among you and your colleagues with rapidly evolving information, you know, that you saw in COVID?
Yeah, certainly. I think every healthcare system trains in what we call hospital incident command, and it goes back to, you know, the best of all worlds, federal and military coming together, looking at how do you manage in a crisis. So it's not unique to SSM Health. Many other institutions institute the same command structure. So some of that command structure has evolved as we worked on this, and we're doing much more rapid communication across larger systems and regions through the internet, through the computer, through virtual meeting. And that has really changed how we manage our supplies, how we escalate safety incidents, how we escalate crises management throughout the region.
Dr. Schwartz, looking ahead, the significance of long COVID, what do you see the path forward for treatment?
It's wonderful to see that there are, you know, this is a big area of research that's still ongoing. And so I can tell you some of the active things that are being looked at are more so in prevention. And so, again, we've talked about vaccination, but then also what is the role for therapeutics like Paxlovid, as far as there may be some early indicators that taking Paxlovid may reduce your risk for long COVID. For a lot of patients who are out there suffering, I think it's important to know that many of the larger academic institutions have research studies established, and some of them are multi-state and cross state lines. And so it may be worth looking into, because I know there are a lot of patients out there who may still be suffering and looking for help. And I'm just hopeful that we will continue to learn more and gain some insight for these patients, so that A, we can prevent the disease in the future for people, and that those who may already be suffering will continue to improve and find treatment that is helpful for them.
Looking at those clinical trials. Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Mark Thompson is Chief Clinical Officer at SSM Health Wisconsin Region. Dr. Allison Schwartz, an infectious disease physician with SSM Health in Wisconsin, also an Associate Medical Director for the Infectious Disease Department. And earlier, we talked with Dr. Mary Beth Graham of Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.